It's hard to remember now, but the internet used to be fun.
I can't believe how easy it is to surf the net.
Surf's up.
On Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet, we'll trace how a tool that once fueled democracy...
Opposition activists organized the march on Facebook.
...became a weapon aimed at the very heart of it.
You're watching the unraveling of our democracy right now.
From Longlead and PRX, this is Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
A long list of U.S. trading partners are getting hit with steep tariffs. Some are asking why.
If your objective is to grow the American economy, I don't think we could call this a success.
I'm Carolyn Buehler. What the Trump tariffs mean for the global economy, and when COVID-19 looks and feels like a much older disease.
A lot of fevers, a lot of joint pains and body pains, loss of appetite. All those symptoms are similar to the symptoms from malaria.
We'll take a look at the early priorities of Pope Leo XIV as he gets to work as the head of the Catholic Church.
Leo has carefully kept his cards close to his chest. He hasn't made any major waves, so we're left to read the tea leaves.
And the Stanley Cup goes on tour. We've got all those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thanks for joining us today. It has been a rough one for dozens of U.S. trading partners because they're now staring down steep tariffs on exports to their biggest consumer market on Earth. The new tariff rates were set by an executive order signed last night by President Donald Trump.
This is making our country very rich and respected again.
But outside of the U.S., the countdown to today's deadline on tariffs was being watched with no small amount of anxiety.
There's only one game in town here this morning, and it is, of course, the tariffs and the array of tariffs that we've gotten.
Global stocks have dropped in the last 30 minutes. The U.S. stock market has opened lower following falls in Europe and Asia as well.
For the businesses and exporters, there is still a sense of uncertainty. They're on the edge. They don't know where they stand.
To get a broader view of the impact these tariffs will have on the global economy, we got in touch with Nicolas Poitier. He's an economist at Bruegel, a think tank based in Brussels.
I'm afraid we don't have a lot of certainty about these tariffs right now. The first reason is domestic law in the United States. But there's also a lot of political uncertainty around these deals. There's a lot of provisions in these deals that are not actually finalized and not totally negotiated. So this might lead to conflict with the deal partners further down the road. But there's also the whole question about some of these commitments that countries have made, for instance, for energy purchases, that these are actually not very credible. They are very high numbers that are unlikely to be delivered. And that sets the tone for maybe a conflict further down the road.
And those commitments for energy, for example, those were made in these bilateral trade deals that countries have struck with the U.S. to avoid the blanket tariffs. There have been several of those agreed to. The idea that Trump had with pushing the start date from April to August was to strike a lot of those deals. How successful was that effort?
It depends really on how you define success. Most economists think these tariffs are in themselves a bad idea. And I think from that standpoint, if your objective is to grow the American economy, I don't think we could call this a success. Now, the question is then, maybe you might want a political success. Maybe you think that basically Trump won something if he struck a deal with a country where he could assert a higher tariff and also some concessions here from these countries. I'm still not sure that I would call this a win, for the simple reason that a lot of these concessions that these countries are supposedly making now, they come down to still a higher tariff that U.S. consumers and businesses will pay for buying products from abroad.
When we talk about deals that have been struck between the U.S. and others, like the EU or like Japan, are those proper, fully worked out trade deals? And how much does that mean that they actually mean?
So these deals that Trump has struck are not real trade deals by the real world meaning of the word, and also very importantly by the legal meaning. The U.S. president has no right to sign trade agreements. So right now, Trump has no right really to sign any real trade agreement. What he does is he offers concessions on this emergency tariffs he put into place, lowering these emergency targets in return to, for instance, lower tariffs on the other side by countries that unilaterally set at a lower tariff rate or concessions, for instance, on investment. But this is also the problem with these tariffs. It's really kind of extending the meaning of the law and going quite far beyond how international trade law is supposed to work. It's violating the most important tenets of international trade law.
We've talked a bit about the potential impact of these tariffs on the U.S. economy. I'm wondering about the impact on the global economy.
So we have some economic modeling on these things, and we've done a meta study where we looked at a number of such modeling done by different academics and institutions. And in generally, it depends a lot on the country, but for most countries, the impact is actually smaller than for the United States itself. So for the United States, this is a significant shock to growth. So this will really be felt both in inflation figures, but also in growth figures. Whereas for most countries, because the U.S. is, for instance, for the European Union, the most important trading partner, but in the end of just one trading partner among many, it's not like in the U.S. case where virtually all our imports are affected. For Europe, it's just that these exports that go to U.S. are affected.
So biggest impact on the U.S., outside of the U.S., is there any big statement you can make about winners and losers here if these tariffs go into effect?
The countries that are most hit from these tariffs are countries like Mexico and Canada that really are deeply integrated in the American economy, and that really we feel now that their products will face a much higher tariff rate than before. The other big losers here is U.S. consumers that will face high inflation and higher prices. If we think in terms of winners, there are not really many. There are some countries that will benefit from slightly better access to U.S. markets than other countries that now face higher tariffs, but it's not very easy to identify winners here. For instance, China faces an average of 50% tariff rate on the exports. That will be to the benefit of countries like Vietnam, but they also face a 20% tariff right now. So really, the balance here is hard to be seen. Generally, most countries or virtually all countries will lose from this.
Are there any other impacts of these tariffs that are not getting enough attention in your mind? Any impacts that we're not really hearing about?
I think there are two things I would mention. One important impact of these tariffs is actually the impact on supply chains, especially for highly complex products like, for instance, pharmaceuticals. Inputs and ingredients can cross borders more than one time. And here, the idea of the United States is to repatriate, for instance, pharmaceutical production by using tariffs on pharma. That can have actually very detrimental effects on the entire industry, not just consumers in the U.S., but also consumers abroad. If you face high tariffs on every time you import something into your supply chain, building a new pharma production line can take 8 to 12 years. So it's not something that you can do on a whim, that you can change and react to something as quickly evolving as the current U.S. trade policy. So we might end up with actually quite high additional costs on these kind of products.
You said there were two major impacts.
Yeah.
And I don't think you got to the second one, did you?
No, I did not. So I think the second important impact here is geopolitics. What we see is that Trump has put tariffs on a lot of allied countries. And these also are somewhat linked with the security provisions that the U.S. has given them. So on the European side, this whole negotiation has really been part of the whole effort of the Europeans to keep Donald Trump engaged in the conflict on Ukraine and also keep the United States in NATO and committed to these security provisions. What the impression is that many people now in U.S. allied countries have is that the U.S. is kind of, to some extent, leveraging its security commitment to these countries. And this starts to look a little bit like extortion, where basically someone that protects you then asks you for money for this protection. And I think this is really undermining the trust in the U.S. as a provider of security. We also see this in countries that are not necessarily traditional U.S. allies, but the U.S. has really trying to court, in particular, in its conflict with China. So I think geopolitically, this is a very worrying development, and it really plays into the hand of China, especially in these East Asian countries.
Nicolas Poitier is an economist at Bruegel, a think tank based in Brussels. Landslides kill more people in India than anywhere else in the world. They're triggered by heavy rains and are a recurring nightmare in India's mountainous areas. Scientists say extreme rainfall linked to climate change is only making things worse. As we reported yesterday, monsoons in South Asia have become more erratic and harder to forecast. Landslides are especially difficult to predict. But as Sushmita Pathak reports from Delhi, some new approaches may help.
The end of July last year brought incessant rain to Wayanad, a hilly district in southern India. rain is typical in July, the peak of the monsoon season. But this spell was so extreme that it triggered a massive landslide. C.K. Vishnudas lives just 40 minutes away from where the disaster occurred.
And it happened in the midnight. That is another tragedy that it took so much of people's life.
Rocks, debris and muddy water gushed 5 miles down the mountain slope, tearing through homes and tea plantations. More than 200 people were killed. Vishnudas drove to the site a couple of days later. The destruction, he says, was unlike anything he'd ever seen.
The kind of boulders that pushed down, it is like almost a two-story building height. So you can imagine the kind of force that was pulling all these debris and soil, water, everything down.
Vishnudas is a conservation ecologist. His work involves studying how climate change is affecting the region. The change is most evident in rainfall patterns. The number of extremely heavy rainfall days has been increasing since 2018, he says. And that means more landslides. The Hume Center for Ecology and Wildlife Biology in Bayanad, where Vishnudas is director, has been studying these landslides.
We did a mapping of each and every point where we had observed these landslides.
The researchers documented previous incidents and classified areas into low, medium, or high landslide probability. They also looked at the main triggering factor of a landslide, rainfall.
Our center has a wide network of rain monitors through community-based weather monitoring system that we started in 2018. We installed weather stations like rain gauges in all these areas and started training local people for measuring data.
After much analysis, they came up with a detailed landslide susceptibility map of Wayanad district. It helps them issue landslide alerts at a hyper-local level, which is not possible for India's National Weather Agency. Identifying areas at high risk of disaster is the first step in preparing for them. But for landslides, India lacks this basic information, says Nirdesh Sharma at the Indian Institute of Technology, Delhi.
There is not enough landslide data. Landslide data in the sense, where have landslides happened, how much have happened, and they're vastly underestimated, to be honest.
Minor landslides often go unnoticed, he says, but can give important clues about an impending disaster. Sharma has seen this many times. He's from Himachal Pradesh, a Himalayan state in northern India, where landslides are common.
Even today, when I go to my home, there are always small rock falls along the route. And last time when I went, we went off the bus and we cleared the rock fall so that the bus could go.
This personal connection motivated Sharma to work on landslide modeling, essentially using machine learning to figure out where landslides are likely to occur. Last year, Sharma and his colleagues published a landslide susceptibility map of the whole country. To do this, they trained a machine learning model with several large-scale data sets, including elevation, soil, proximity to roads, and more.
We took all this data and then we took some historical landslide data and we used machine learning to create a mapping between them to understand which are the factors that cause high landslide susceptibility. And using this whole framework, we developed the landslide susceptibility map for India.
In his office, Sharma pulls up the map on a large monitor. You can zoom into any 100 meter by 100 meter square of India and check landslide risk. That kind of resolution is a first for landslide maps in India. Areas like Wayanad, with a history of landslides, show up red and orange. But there are also some unexpected orange patches in the mountainous area of eastern India. These are new landslide hotspots created by climate change, says Sharma.
Due to climate change, there will be change in rainfall patterns. The rainfalls are supposed to become more intense and more short duration, which will impact some areas which have never seen landslides historically.
Manavendra Saharia, who was also part of the research, says the map of landslide risk should be used as a starting point.
In terms of its application, it is immense because I think from the planning perspective, any kind of infrastructure that we are putting in place, be it a railway station, an unfortunate incident happened 2 years back when an entire railway station was washed out by a landslide. So those kind of incidents can be prevented.
India is expected to implement an early warning system for landslides by 2030. Until then, smaller, more localized efforts are underway in several parts of the country, including in Wayanad. C.K. Vishnudas says 3 evacuations have already been carried out this season.
There is a very positive change that we observed. Like this year monsoon, the district administration very closely working with us And preparedness started much early, like in the month of April itself.
Vishnudas says last year's catastrophic landslide was a wake-up call about this growing threat and the need to prepare. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Delhi.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Peru is still grappling with a violent chapter in its recent history. In the 1980s and 90s, the government fought two rebel groups. Soldiers and police killed an estimated 70,000 civilians. Since then, the Peruvian government has worked toward finding accountability. But that could change. An amnesty bill on the president's desk right now would offer blanket amnesty to people accused of human rights violations. Charles Walker is a historian at UC Davis. He says it is hard to say how many people the amnesty would apply to.
Still, there's much to be investigated. Peru is complicated. I do want to say that, you know, the Shining Path committed over 50% of those killings are guilty for over 50%.
That was one of the rebel groups that the government was battling
against.
Exactly,
the Shining Path. And so there are many, many groups that still want to hold trials. There are also groups that are still searching for the disappeared, believe that this is just one more indication the government's going to give up, that they're going to stop this sort of work.
So what is the reasoning in favor of passing this bill?
These are very powerful people. The military still has a lot of influence. Soldiers and much of Peru believe these were battles against terrorism. These were sacrifices made. It was a long time ago. You know, it's time to move on. The former president Fujimori and his followers are adamant about this. It's one of their their foundational beliefs that this human rights was concerns were excessive, and that Peru needs to move on and embrace the 21st century.
And that president, the president from the years of the crackdown, Alberto Fujimori, he actually was convicted and went to jail for a time for things that happened during that period. Correct?
Yes, which was. His followers mourn about and consider this a grave injustice, the man who, quote unquote, saved Peru.
So we've touched on some of the things that happened during this conflict, but can you give me the overview of what happened in the 80s and 90s that ended up with these 70,000 civilians being killed?
Yeah, it was an atrocious period. I lived in Peru for much of the time. The Shining Path was a sort of unexpected Maoist group, unlike other guerrilla groups in Latin America. Very violent. They also confronted civil groups. They attacked other people on the left. And because the victims were primarily indigenous, rural, and I think it was something like the Peruvian Truth Commission, three-quarters of the victims were indigenous, spoke Quechua. There was less concern, less attention to this nationally and globally. The Peruvian Truth Commission, in its report, came up with this number of 70,000 dead, just shocking. And so now Peru is very divided, like much of the world, and those seeking justice about this want to continue to try those guilty, including members of the Shining Path, and in a few cases, the second guerrilla group.
You've mentioned this Truth Commission, which was established in the early 2000s. How has Peru been at grappling with this dark past?
It's, it depends on where you go and who you ask. It's very frustrating. They have a beautiful memory museum, and it was seen by conservatives as it's overly critical of the military and the police and insufficiently critical of the Shining Path, which is completely false. I know it well. So there's a very strong movement, people who just say, let's move on. That happened in the past. And you know, critics will say, well, it didn't happen to your family. And the fact that it happened particularly to women, rural folks, indigenous people, also this hastens this move on theory. So it's, again, Peru is very divided. I think this is not going to go away quietly. That's for sure.
What kind of successes did the Truth and Reconciliation Commission have for the victims and their families?
Well, just naming people, the numbers, processing it was an incredibly valuable document. There's a certain paradox. It was so critical of everyone in the sense it said the press needed to pay more attention to this, didn't cover it sufficiently because it was rural rather than urban. It was darker-skinned people rather than light-skinned people. It was critical of the Catholic Church who had, you know, some who dismissed human rights. It also had leading human rights figures. It was dismissive of all of society, saying this was a, you know, terrible indictment on Peru. And in some ways, it was so critical. Many people said, well, it wasn't my fault or dodge guilt about this.
Is the president expected to sign the bill into law?
Groups are still holding out that she won't sign it. There'll be enough protest. But right now, she's completely aligned with the most conservative groups in Peru. And everything indicates that she'll sign it.
UC Davis historian Charles Walker spoke with us from Peru. The next NHL season doesn't start until October, but hockey fanatics in select areas are in for a treat. Before then, the world's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Earlier this summer, the Florida Panthers earned the magical moment of becoming the 2025 NHL champions.
Panther perfection!
The team piled together in one big hug on the ice. But players really started whooping and hollering when they got their hands on the trophy. That, of course, is the famous Stanley Cup. After the win, the athletes entered the offseason. But for the Stanley Cup itself, the work is just getting started.
It goes to everybody's hometown, and they become part of the celebration.
Phil Pritchard is the official keeper of the Stanley Cup. Since 1988, it's been his job to safeguard and escort the coveted trophy year-round.
I thought I'd be winning the Stanley Cup when I was 14, but that never worked out.
This gig, he knows, is the next best thing. Every summer, Pritchard takes the cup on a 100-day world tour. Players and staff members of the winning team get to show off the cup, back where their stories began.
The tour will start in Canada and then go to the U.S. from there and then overseas and then back.
Based on the roster of this year's team, the cup will travel overseas to Finland, the Czech Republic, Latvia, Sweden, and Russia. Over the years, though, Pritchard says he's traveled all over with the cup.
We've been in northern Siberia with it. We've been to the Great Wall of China. We've only been once below the equator, and that's with Australia.
The celebrations can look quite a bit different depending on the location. Pritchard has noticed that in Europe, it's common for athletes to get a key to their city, while North American towns tend to hold parades, like a few weeks ago in Quebec.
C'est incroyable. C'est important pour moi d'être avec le monde qui m'a aidé.
Star forward AJ Greer got emotional as he told local media how much it means to be able to share the cup with the people who have always supported him. Keeper Phil Pritchard says that's what the tour is all about.
It's pretty powerful. It's pretty emotional because in hockey, you can't do it by yourself. And I don't think these players or staff members ever forget that.
Some stops on the tour, though, lean a bit sillier. Canadians have historically eaten poutine right out of the cup. One Finn filled it with a traditional salmon soup, and in Slovakia, it's been a vessel for pierogies. This summer, the cup has already hit two pop culture milestones. A staff member filled it with Labubu plush toys, and it also made it onto the Coldplay Kiss Cam. Yeah, that kiss cam.
Yes, I see. All right.
Who knows what the cup will get up to over the next couple of months of the tour. It's due back at the Hockey Hall of Fame in Toronto by the time the next NHL season starts in early October. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Hundreds of Catholic social media influencers are gathered in Rome this week as the Vatican takes an increasing interest in spreading the faith online. Albertine Dabakar is a nun from France with more than 300,000 Instagram followers.
Je crois que rien que l'existence de cet événement dit quelque chose.
This event shows that the Vatican is behind us and our mission, she told Agence France-Presse. Father Giuseppe Fusari says it's an opportunity for Catholic influencers to get to know each other.
Essere, chiamiamoli missionari digitali che è meglio.
Let's call ourselves digital missionaries, he says. That's better than influencers. This week is the culmination of the Catholic Church's once-every-quarter-century Jubilee celebration. As the world's Matthew Bell reports, it's also a moment for the newly installed Pope Leo XIV to step into the global spotlight.
The summer months are usually pretty quiet at the Vatican. Popes in the past would spend much of the season in retreat at the Apostolic Palace of Castel Gandolfo. It's about 15 miles outside of Rome. But Pope Leo only took 2 weeks vacation. And early this week, he made a surprise visit to St. Peter's Square, where he got a rock star's welcome. In brief remarks to the crowd of Catholic youth, the first ever American-born pope did something he doesn't do very often. He spoke in English.
Jesus tells us, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world.
Pope Leo XIV has been on the job for less than 3 months. And in terms of papal politics, that means he's really just getting started.
Much is made of a president's first 100 days. And that's because a president is elected for a very short period of time in comparison to a pope who has a lifetime appointment.
Christopher White is the author of a new book called Pope Leo XIV, Inside the Conclave and the Dawn of a New Papacy.
Leo has carefully kept his cards close to his chest. He hasn't made any major waves. So we're left to read the tea leaves. You know, the strong signals that he has offered us so far is that he wants to continue in the direction of Pope Francis, to examine how the Catholic Church's structures might be reconsidered to become more welcoming, more open, more hospitable. But I think he's signaled also that he's going to do so at a more cautious pace.
And that helps explain why Leo was chosen by his fellow Catholic cardinals to become pope after Francis died in late April. Teresa Berger admits that, like most Vatican watchers, she was surprised when the announcement came that Robert Prevost from Chicago would be the next pope. Berger is a professor of liturgical studies and Catholic theology at Yale Divinity School.
That said, Pope Leo actually, I don't think of primarily as a U.S. American, but as a pope coming from the Americas. He has dual citizenship, U.S. Peruvian. And I think that's the best way actually to read this choice.
Berger says the cardinals wanted someone with extensive experience, and that's what they got with Leo, whose style is very different from his predecessor.
Pope Leo, as a global leader, is much more cautious in what he says, much less given to sort of popular bon mots that are repeated forever and ever, like, who am I to judge in response to what about the question of homosexuality? I don't think we'll ever get an unguarded pronouncement like that from Pope Leo XIV, but he might surprise me.
It's going to take another 6 months or even a year to have a better understanding of what this new pope is all about, says Thomas Rees. He's a Jesuit priest and a senior analyst at the Religion News Service. Rees says Leo has already managed to walk a difficult political dividing line inside the Catholic world.
Both conservatives and liberal Catholics think he's on their side.
The conservative Catholics were very pleased when he came out on the balcony dressed like Pope Benedict. But liberal Catholics listened to what he said. He may dress like Pope Benedict, but he talks like Pope Francis.
Rees says that Leo is not shying away from some big global issues. On Wednesday, the new pope spoke to an audience at St. Peter's Square and mentioned the Helsinki Accords. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the multilateral agreements of 1975 that helped lower the temperature of the Cold War and put human rights and religious freedom in the international spotlight. Thomas Rees says the Vatican takes the long view on these issues and that Leo is pointing to Helsinki for a reason.
It shows that it is possible if countries come together and dialogue and try and seek compromise and agreement for the common good of humanity. And the Vatican, I think, wants to remind the world constantly that that is possible. Peace is possible.
This week, Pope Leo expressed deep sorrow for the victims of a deadly attack at a church in eastern Congo. And here he is speaking in July after the Israeli attack at a church in Gaza that killed three Palestinians.
Prego per le vittime, Saad Issa Kostandi Salam, Fomia Issa Latif Ajad, Najwa Ibrahim Latif Abu Daud.
Leo read the names of the three people who were killed, and he called for an end to attacks against civilians and the barbarity of war. Massimo Fagioli is a Catholic theologian at Trinity College in Dublin. He says the Pope has also sent strong signals about how he views the war in Ukraine.
Pope Leo has received in audience President Zelensky during his vacation in Castel Gandolfo, which was really extraordinary. It doesn't happen usually that the Pope, during his summer vacation, receives a head of state, but that signals that the Holy See under Pope Leo is much closer to Ukraine than before.
Fagioli says the Vatican's foreign policy under Leo could end up aligning more closely with liberal Western democracies compared to the era of Pope Francis. But again, it's early days. This pope is not even 70 years old yet, and he's really just getting started. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Persistent and lingering exhaustion, dizzy spells, difficulty concentrating and focusing like your brain is in a fog. These are some of the symptoms of long COVID. And here is a figure about it that surprised us. Of 2,000 people who got COVID in Ethiopia and Uganda, as many as two-thirds reported having long-term symptoms. That's according to new research being led by Jane Achan, a physician in Uganda.
So essentially what we did was get a population of people that had been diagnosed with COVID in the past, clinically evaluated based on clinical history, but also physical examination. And we compared these people with what we call control. So we did find the symptomatology in those who had had COVID as symptoms that do not exist in the general population in these locations.
I was just looking this up, and the WHO estimates that 6 out of every 100 people who are infected with COVID develop long COVID. There's a recent study in the British Medical Journal finding that it was more prevalent than that, 25% of patients in middle and high income countries. But patients from less wealthy nations actually were much more likely. So your number is even higher. What do you attribute those differences to?
I think some of the differences are largely due to the study designs that have been described before. So a lot of the long COVID studies are really phone-based interviews or questionnaires that are sent out to individuals and they report back. We did a bit more than that. And we think that during the acute illness, we did find that those that had the severe manifestations, the older individuals, those that, for example, needed oxygen therapy, the symptomatology was higher in those that really had the more severe manifestations of acute COVID compared to those that had the milder forms.
So could this potential disparity cited by the BMJ in COVID rates between lower and higher income countries, could that be down to treatment during the acute COVID phase?
It could be down due to treatment. I think that's one of the attributes. But also, I think post-treatment care. We did have patients that had symptoms for up to 2 years, and these were really concerning symptoms, some of them debilitating in a proportion of the population, and really presenting a significant challenge to the health system in terms of tracking and really providing the necessary care for these category of patients.
So you are an advisor to the Malaria Consortium, and you have looked into the overlap between COVID and malaria. What did you find?
So in our interviews with the patients, we found a lot of fevers, a lot of joint pains and body pains, loss of appetite. All those symptoms are similar to the symptoms that a patient with malaria does have. So from the perception of the patient, they are suffering from malaria. But what we found was actually the reverse. So the burden of malaria was much lower in those with long COVID and those that had had COVID before compared to the general population. And we think that there are multiple explanations for that. First of all, because they'd been having these lingering complications for so long, they were utilizing malaria prevention measures much better. So we looked at, for example, utilization of bed nets. Healthcare-seeking behavior was much better in those that had the long-term complications compared to the general population.
So people thought that they had malaria, but they really had complications of long COVID.
They did have complications.
Actually, malaria rates were lower people who had had COVID, probably because of protective measures they were taking because they thought they might have malaria.
Yes.
So is that impactful at all in how you might educate people or talk about long COVID? I mean, if malaria is relatively common and a lot of people think they have it when they don't, does that imply any public health measures that need to be taken?
Yes, I think for us, it's really the message is around the clinical care provision for individuals generally, not just individuals that are coming in with COVID. For example, the evaluation of these participants was quite narrow. Many times they were receiving the diagnosis of long COVID for the first time in the context of this study. So one of the key messages is really for us to explain the fact that indeed long-term complications do exist, and we need to have clinical care guidelines for the diagnosis, but also for the treatment. Mm-hmm. So really a patient that has chronic multiple comorbidities, how does a health system in Africa provide holistic care for these participants? And those are the conversations that we are having with the ministries of health in both countries, just to ensure that if I have a complication, I don't have to go to 5 clinics. How do you provide holistic care to an individual that may have diabetes, a heart condition, a mental health condition, and, you know, lingering respiratory complications? That's the kind of lesson we've learned, and that's the kind of public health messaging we are hoping to pass forward with the findings from this study.
Jane Achan is an advisor and researcher with the Malaria Consortium. She's based in Kampala, Uganda. A stockpile of contraceptives destined for women in sub-Saharan Africa is languishing in a Belgian warehouse. The pills, implants, and IUDs are perfectly fine, but the agency that was meant to distribute them is USAID, and its funding has been slashed by the Trump administration. Family planning NGOs, some European governments, and at least one United Nations agency have all offered to distribute the contraceptives for free. But so far, the U.S. government is sticking with its plan to incinerate them. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
The contraceptive devices stuck in Geel, Belgium, are worth $10 million.
This would provide pregnancy prevention for more than 650,000 people for up to 1 year, and then 950,000 people for 3 to 10 years, because there's long-acting methods included in that stock.
This is Rachel Milkovich with the international aid organization Doctors Without Borders, or MSF. She says when MSF learned of the orphaned contraceptives this spring, it reached out to the State Department, which had absorbed what was left of USAID.
So we were making that call in saying that the best thing that can happen for these supplies right now is for it to get to in-country ministries of health as soon as possible, and that MSF is able to provide technical support to facilitate that if help is needed with distribution.
Milkovich says they waited for an answer and waited.
But we didn't hear back.
The World has also contacted the State Department multiple times, but has yet to get a response for this story. Other media outlets report that the government plans to incinerate the contraceptives at a special medical waste facility in France. And there's a cost to U.S. taxpayers, about $167,000. As to why the U.S. ignored MSF's free offer to move the goods, so far the government hasn't said, but there are clues.
Pleasure to speak to you from the beautiful Oval Office.
This was President Donald Trump addressing the annual Walk for Life march on a jumbotron in Washington, D.C. in January.
And thank you for turning out once again to show your extraordinary love and compassion for the unborn.
Speaking to this anti-abortion rally was one of President Trump's first acts in office. He also revived what's known as the Global Gag Rule. The rule forbids the U.S. government from funding any overseas family planning groups that offer, support, or even discuss abortions with women. Sarah Shaw is with MSI Reproductive Choices, a London-based NGO that offers family planning services, including abortions, in 34 countries.
The fact that that was one of the earliest actions of the administration sends a very clear message. And I see that the failure to allow these commodities to get into the hands of the women that need them, I just see that as a further advancement of that position.
Shaw says MSI approached the USAID contractor responsible for the supplies in Belgium, a company called Chemonix, with the same offer MSF made, to move the materials free of charge. Chemonix, she said, conveyed an answer, presumably from the U.S. government.
They just said they wanted to recoup full shelf value. And we went backwards and forwards a little bit, but, you know, they weren't budging. We weren't able to pay.
A spokesman for Chemonix told the world it cannot comment and directed me back to the State Department. MSI couldn't pay for the goods, but the United Nations Population Fund could. Karen Hong runs supply chain management for UNFPA out of Copenhagen. She says they also reached out to the U.S.
I don't think we actually got a proper reply from USAID. So in some ways, we were ghosted.
The Belgian and French governments have chimed in, trying to negotiate some sort of handover, but so far, no deal. Again, UNFPA's Karen Hong.
It's truly devastating, because we know that in all the countries that we operate in, we know that there's a lot of women and girls out there that would not have enough supplies to keep them going. And now, on the other hand, hearing that there are supplies available, but the decision was to destroy it, it hurts.
The French government says it has no knowledge of when the U.S. intends to ship the materials to France for incineration, but it says it opposes the decision. Now, some French political parties are demanding that President Emmanuel Macron speak out more forcefully. Melissa Camara is with France's Green Party. She told French TV that allowing the contraceptives to be destroyed would endanger women in countries with limited health care. France has an official feminist foreign policy, stressing equal rights for women and men. So doing nothing to save the contraceptives could prove embarrassing. But it's unclear just how Macron might stop the incineration from happening. What is clear, says MSF's Rachel Milkovich, USAID is already sorely missed in global family planning.
The U.S. government funded almost 25% of all donated contraceptive commodities to low and middle income countries. So this is a huge gap that cannot be filled overnight.
To think about any available contraceptives being incinerated, she says, is unfathomable. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Spanish Commission for Refugees tries to protect the rights of those arriving in the country. It also works on the issue of social exclusion. Recently, the commission's refugee football team was officially recognized and embraced by the Spanish Olympic Committee. The roster includes migrants from all over the world, and the team plays in a league in the city of Madrid with the hope that through football, locals and refugees can foster better understanding. From our partners at Deutsche Welle, DW, Ashish Sharma has the story.
Muy buenas tardes a todos. Bienvenidos al Comité Olímpico Español.
Inspired by the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, which set up an Olympic refugee team, Spain has been at the forefront of integration programs in sports for refugees, and the Spanish Olympic Committee has been leading the way. It helped in the funding and construction of the world's first ever sports center dedicated to refugees, built in the suburbs of Madrid in 2021. The center is named after Alejandro Blanco, the president of the Spanish Olympic Committee, and in collaboration with the Spanish Commission for Refugees, it has opened its doors to the refugee football team.
Hoy hablamos del fútbol, pero We started to think about how we could help refugees together through sport. Today we talk about football, but I won't forget that we also have helped basketball players, athletes, boxers, tennis players. We have done many things trying to help refugees. We are not looking for a medal here. There is no first, second, or third place.
According to the IOC, there are more than 120 million people worldwide who've been displaced from their homes.
Buenas tardes. La verdad, desde el club, como cuando me hablaron de...
Alan Neom is a professional footballer who plays for the Madrid-based La Liga side Getafe. He was born in France, but his mother hails from Cameroon. As his career established at international level, he opted to play for Cameroon instead of France. Neom says sport plays a vital part in helping refugees integrate.
It's very important because it will help them for get involved in the life, you know, in the Spanish life. And I hope that will help them to find a job or find a better life. I think there will be a good integration. They will have a good integration with the Spanish people, and the football or the sport will help them.
22-year-old Destiny Umofuman from Nigeria is one of the refugee players. It took him 6 years to get from Nigeria to Spain, and in the last 2 years he's been trying to build a new life here in Madrid, and playing football has become an important part of that.
Life has been good, I would say. Since I got here, like I've been able to study, you know, also try to integrate into the system, and also learn the culture and the language and everything, and also the football team as well. And also, I am in the process of achieving my goals and my dreams.
So you're playing for this football team. How important is that for you as someone who, you know, has just come here and is in a different culture, different language?
So it's very important for me because at the end we all have the same stories, the same district because we are all in the same situation. So the football team for me is like a way to. It's like another way to find out that, okay, I have a brother from another country, it doesn't matter, from Venezuela, from Morocco, from Nigeria also, that is also in the same situation with me. I mean, like similar situations, all the same situation that is also trying to integrate into a new system, trying to learn a new language. And also, for me, it's very important because at the end of the day, I don't have anything doing at the weekends. So when I know that I have a plan during the weekend, so it also helps me to disconnect a little bit about what is going on back in my country.
What about integration with Spanish people? Because it's a team of refugees. So do you get much connection or contact with actually local Spanish people?
We are playing in a private league, so we have a lot of connection with the locals, and we like talk with them. And sometimes we also have friends. We make friends in between ourselves. At the end of the year, football is everything. Football is a language. It's a way to interact with people. It's friendship. It's love. And football don't has any barrier. There's no limit when it comes to football.
Veronica Cheble is the marketing director of the Spanish Commission for Refugees. She says creating a team sport environment is a positive way to help individual refugees overcome their traumas.
It's a place, safety place for them to play and to forget things and to heal, to belong to something after leaving all behind, to belong to a team. They don't feel alone trying to get integrated in the society. So this team is also opening a door to tell all the stories behind the team.
The support of the Spanish Olympic Committee has been vital to refugees. It's hoped that moments like this will not only help refugees feel integrated, but also be part of the process to help them recover from the traumas that have taken them so far away from their homes and families.
Ashish Sharma reports for our partners at Deutsche Welle. Summer is music festival season, and for metalheads, this weekend is the big one, Wacken Open Air in northern Germany. The lineup runs the whole gamut of metal subgenres, from the campy power metal of Windrose, who we're hearing now, to melt-your-face-off black metal from the likes of 1349 and Dark Funeral. The festival is expected to attract 85,000 people, dwarfing the population of Wacken itself. Just 2,000 people live there. The metal festival started small in 1990. Nowadays, the venue has its own independent infrastructure with electrical, plumbing, and waste collection. It also features a sophisticated traffic management system and, get this, an underground beer pipeline. That was built in 2017 and can move over 2,600 gallons of beer per hour to make sure the taps never run dry. This year's festival still has two more nights of headbanging revelry, and most of the lineup's biggest names have yet to take the stage. Taking us out today is a song performed at Wacken last year, the American band Baroness playing Isaac. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and look for our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH, all one word. Check us out and subscribe. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend, and we will see you back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Steve Henn, Dan Shee and Ted McGovern, Sharon G. and Robert Ryan, and Frederica and Howard Stevenson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.